So here we are, back again. So today we are going to move a little bit forward in some of our discussions from the past few weeks, pull together a number of very, very important loose ends. And then we're going to just begin to touch upon the story of Job, of Eov. And he's going to actually spend a significant amount of time discussing that story. Obviously, if we've been talking about suffering, the source, the book of suffering throughout really all of time is the book of Job. And we'll review the story of Job. And Nachmanides actually has a commentary on the book of Job. So this is snippets. This is parts of his commentary. But it's more of like the big picture of what the story is all about, which we'll be studying together as well. But we're just going to touch upon that. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's jump in just mention one thing which is going to throw us off a little bit, but it's an important part of the equation. Until now, we've been talking about suffering typically being something that is there to cleanse someone from sin. That's the way he's been framing it. In the next paragraph over here, he mentions, almost like in passing, by the way, there are other possible factors. Okay, so let's just read it together. So we're at the beginning of the first page. Kederech sheyesh betzadikim. It's actually a little, okay, some of the copying is actually not, okay, we're actually going to start on the second line of the Hebrew text. It was supposed to be in bold, but it didn't come out that way in the copy. All right. Veyesh, so it's the second line of the Hebrew. There are those, sheposkim lo chayim v'shalva lechesed avosav. There are those who have life and tranquility due to the goodness of their forefathers. In other words, there's something called zchus avos, the merit of one's ancestors. We invoke it every day when we pray. We say, you know, God, in the merit of our forefathers, you know, do good things to us. So that's true not only for the forefathers, those who came all the way before us, but there is this notion, just like we could inherit finances from our ancestors. A person passes away, they leave money behind for their children. We could also receive spiritual, you know, finances, so to speak, from our ancestors. And so some of the equation, until now he's been focusing very much on the individual and saying the reason this happens to you is because of the fact that you did X or did not do Y. But now he's saying, you know what, there's another factor, and that is that we could also inherit some of the credit from those who came before us, and that could be an additional factor as to why things could be happening to a person, okay? So that's one additional factor, almost like an addendum to our larger discussion. V'yesh, and I'm skipping to the next line. We're at the third Hebrew line. V'yesh shema'arichin lo, and there are those sometimes who really they should not, they should really perhaps have passed due to their misdeeds or whatever. But yesh shema'arichin lo ashiyadshuv b'tshuva. There are those who, although they should be punished, God delays their punishments in order to give the person the opportunity to repent. I'm going to move my seat because everyone's on this side today. So this is good. I like this. Let's do this more often. I'm scrunching my head. Okay. Here we are. Okay. So, right, the next point that he makes is that there are people, there are scenarios where a person really, for all intents and purposes, they should, you know, in Rosh Hashanah, their judgment dictates that really they should be, they should pass this year because of their sins, their misdeeds, but in order to give the person the opportunity to do tshuva, God is compassionate in that fashion. So this is, we say in the 13 attributes, we speak about the fact that God is slow to anger. What does that mean, God is slow to anger? It takes him a long time. It builds up his anger. No, God is not human. We're not describing human features, but it's a way that God interacts with the world. It's a system that we give like a human attribute to. So slow to anger in a person would mean that, you know, they're patient, whatever it is. With God, there's a system. One of the systems that God uses is that although at times we may be deserving of being punished right now, but for the sake of giving us the opportunity, God is good. God wants to give us opportunity to change, and therefore he will delay his punishment in order to give us the opportunity to change. That's what it means when we say God is slow to anger. That's what he's describing over here. One more of these addendums. There's source sheets right next to you over the beam. Okay. Umin ha-ga'onim. The ga'onim. Who are the ga'onim? Just very quickly, this is worth pointing out just so we know historically. There were, you know, the Talmud finishes being written around, you know, 6th century. 6th century, the Talmud is concluded. After that period, for the next more or less few hundred years, 500 years-ish, we have a period of time where we call the rabbis from that era ge'onim. Ge'onim literally means like ga'on is a genius. Okay, but it's not necessarily a reflection of their you know, IQ, although I'm sure they were very smart. But the leaders, specifically, usually the leaders of the Babylonian Jewish community, the main source of the Jews were primarily living in Babylon, modern day Iraq, and that's the center of Judaism. The people who were leading those, you know, communities were called Gaonim. So whenever you hear the word Gaon, with one exception, who's the one exception? Typically, the Vilna Gaon. There's someone who lived a few hundred years ago who was known as the Vilna Gaon. That's because he was just a genius. He really, truly was a genius. But typically, what he's referring to over here is the Gaonim are the people who lived, or the era before him. And he's not just saying who, but he says that there is another addendum, and that is, Gaonim Omrim. The Gaonim said, Shekadosh Baruch Hu. Oh no, it's really messed up over here. Okay, one second. Sorry, there's some of the text is confused over here. Okay, Shiyu, I'm just going to skip to the end of the second last line. Shimachzikim berishan. Okay, something got messed up in the copy. I'll just paraphrase. So I'll read the English. Something Gaonim said, the Holy One blessed me, apportions tranquility for the evildoers to test the evildoers so that if they will stay in their bad ways. And what he means by this is as follows. In Tzono, he's mentioned two forms of good that could happen to someone. Merits of our ancestors. B, in order to delay punishment to give us an opportunity to repent. And now he's mentioning a third factor. Sometimes God will do good to those who are evil as a way of testing them or testing others. You know, we see people who are, you know, doing bad things and great things are happening to us. So we think to ourselves, hey, if this is what happens to those who do bad, why should I bother doing what's right? Right? So it's almost as a way of testing and setting a stage for the rest of us. Will we be swayed by the good that happens to them? So it may not be a reward for them. It may not be, it may not be even about them. It's about others that God wants to create an equilibrium in the world. And if we see, imagine a world where all the tzaddikim, all the good people will be living in mansions and good things, and they'll be healthy and everything will be great. And all those who do what's bad will be living on the streets and in huts and they're living this terrible life. What would happen? We'd have no free will, right? Free will would be out the window. If it's that clear, right, that if there's A to B to C, like it's so clear that if good is happening to us, that so he's suggesting a third point, and that is sometimes in order to create an equilibrium, in order to not to test us, but in order to create a world where we are not, where there is free will, it's critical that even those who are evil are living okay lives, and sometimes good lives, in order to make it that it's not so obvious that you should just do what's good. God wants us to have free will. Without free will, our lives would be meaningless, right? So in order for there to really be free will, it's critical that those who are evil are also living good lives, okay? So this is all a short paragraph. He's just mentioning, it's a little confusing, but his point is that there are other factors that go in. When we just watch and we say, hey, you know, some of this good things are happening to this person. It must be they're a tzaddik. Bad things are happening to this person. It must be they're a rasha. I hope at this point we've been disabused of that notion, right? This notion, and you find this, there's a what do they call it? The Church of Prosperity? Is that what it's called? That's the term? Yeah, so there's this notion, there's this notion that, God loves you, so therefore good things are going to happen to you, right? There's these very popular preachers, or no, there's a better, like televangelists, right? Is that the word? Yeah, and basically they'll have these, late night TV, I guess, and basically they'll be telling you, like, give us, money to our church and good things will happen to you, and I'll prove to you that good things are happening because, look, I'm living the life. Yeah, because all these silly suckers are sending them money. Excuse my language. But the point is that we believe that life's a little more complex than that. You can't say, oh, look, they're everything's great, so it must be you're doing what's right. No, maybe you're a terrible person. You're getting a reward in this world. Maybe your ancestors did great things and therefore getting reward. Maybe you're having it good so that everyone else could see a Russia having a good life and therefore be, have to think twice before doing what's right. So that notion of like the world being so simplistic that we could see, yeah, good things happen, therefore I'm good. Bad things happen, therefore I'm bad. He's trying to broaden our understanding and recognize there's so many different factors that are at play that we shouldn't jump to those conclusions. That's what I would say is the general takeaway to this last point. But now, with all this in mind, here he asks what I think is the million-dollar question. This is one of my favorite little sections to me. And that is that, based on everything that he said, should anyone who is knowledgeable in Jewish thought ever ask the question of why do bad things happen to good people? Is that question ever, based on what we're describing over here, where he just finished explaining to us that the system, there's so much complexity. And not only that, but oftentimes the best of people will have to suffer the most, and the worst of people will have the greatest benefits. Based on the main thesis that he mentioned, which is that there's two worlds, and therefore it's critical that the bad people receive the reward here, the good people receive their punishment here, so that things will be better in the world to come. So anyone who knows anything, based after you walk out of this class, would you ever say, well, hey, why is this bad person having a good life? Why is this good person having a bad life? Should you ask that question? Probably not, it would seem, right? So now he's going to ask, wait a second, if that's the case, if what I just explained to you is our traditional view, there's a problem here. Because some really impressive leaders of the Jewish people asked this precise question. This question of tzadik viralo, rasha vitovlo, of why bad things happen to good people, why good things happen to bad people, this question has been asked by many great people well before us. And let's read that question together. Vim tishal, and if you will ask v'tomer, you'll say, hare shetiknu chachamim dvarim halalu, lefi kavalasa. The sages established these matters, meaning everything we spoke about, according to their tradition. Ulefi hechreach psuke hatorah vanevim, and according to the compelling read, I'm sorry, there's so many spelling mistakes in these, I'm sorry, I read these pretty quickly. Okay, and the compelling read of Torah and Nevi'im. Im kain, if so, mahuzeh, ay, 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 okay. The Hebrew is all warped. I don't know what happened here. Okay. We're going to just read it in English today. Bear with me. I'm sorry. Maybe I shouldn't apologize. Some of you are happy about that. Okay. But whatever. The Hebrew is all, there's something that, okay. I'm not sure why the format came out all wrong. But he says like this. If you will say, the sages established the matters that we've been talking about according to their tradition and according to the compelling read of the Torah Nevi'im. If so, what is this that the prophets cry out over this matter? What is it that Yirmiyahu was shocked over the evildoers? Jeremiah, the prophet, he was the one who witnessed the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And in the book of Eicha and elsewhere, he laments. He's like, what's going on? Why is it that all these evildoers, right? The Babylonians are marching on our temple. They are, you know, we have traditions of the general of the Babylonians going into the Holy of Holies and committing lewd acts on top of a Torah scroll in the Holy of Holies. And he's like, what's going on? Like, how could this be? And he's victorious and the Babylonians are enjoying themselves. And we who serve you, all these bad things are happening. He was shocked and he yells out like, how could this be, right? And that David said, King David, throughout Tehillim, very oftentimes asks forms of this question of why is it that the evil people in the world seem to be flourishing and those who are righteous, chassidav, your devout ones, he's speaking about himself and others, are constantly suffering, right? These are questions asked by David. And Yeshayahu, Isaiah was shocked. And Habakkuk said, okay, and basically time and time again, you have prophet after prophet after prophet asking the question of why are good things happening to bad people? Why are bad things happening to good people? And what's the story? Are all these people illiterate? We're the knowledgeable one? And Isaiah, Jeremiah, Habakkuk, and David HaMelech, King David, they didn't know the answers to these questions. We do? That doesn't seem right, right? And Eov and his friends argued about this a lot. And our sages themselves said, okay, we say in Pirkei Avos, we do not have the ability to understand the tranquility of the evildoers or the afflictions of the righteous, right? Pirkei Avos basically says, well, we, you know, this notion, so we don't understand it. And he's saying, what do you mean you don't understand it? I just finished spending, you know, the past 5 weeks explaining it, right? We understand it. And King David, Jeremiah, Isaiah, the authors of Pirkei Avos, they don't understand, but we do. We're missing something over here. There seems to be an inconsistency. If there really is a system and we can understand the system, then why are these great prophets and great leaders asking the question that we just finished answering? You with me? This is very bothersome, right? I remember, you know, that's such a good question. Such a good question, right? Right? So let's see what he answers. Da. So he says like this. He's going to suggest two different answers to this question, okay? Let's see if the Hebrew is better in this one. Yeah, the Hebrew is better in this last paragraph. Okay. Da, you should know. Sheyesh mirabosenu hachalukim bezu hamida. There are those of our sages who disagree with this approach. Yesh mehem misha omer, there are those who say, ein misa below chet, velo yisurin below avon. There are those who say, quite similar to what we just laid out, that there is no death without sin and no punishment without iniquity. Meaning the theory that we've been laying out, the idea that the Ramban has been saying that when a person suffers, it's because we've done some misdeeds and it needs to be cleansed. V'nidchu bidvar begemara, however, in the Talmud, this view is argued upon. And there are those who say, no, that's not true. Sheyesh mehen shemesu be'itav shel nachash hakadmoni. There are those who argue that some died in this world completely innocent. Why do they die then, if they're completely innocent? Because of something described as the snake, the bite of the snake. What does it mean, the bite of the snake? What are they referring to, of course? Gan Eden, the first snake. The snake that is in dialogue, right? V'hu cheto shel Adam harishon. This is the sin that of Adam harishon. Okay, let's pause over here just to appreciate what's going on over here. There is, yes, go ahead. I know you're about, yeah. Christian thoughts, right? So this is, okay. Yes, we do. Sort of, in a different way. Okay, so there is this, I hear all the time. Yes, good, sorry, I'm just giving you a hard time. So, what original sin? I'm no Christian expert, okay? But let's do a quick review. What I'm about to say now is Christianity, and then we'll see how this compares or doesn't compare to Jewish thoughts. In Christianity, there's this notion of original sin. What does original sin mean? It means that Adam and Eve sinned, and because of that, all of the world is damned. That's the way they frame it, okay? Now,
therefore
it requires grace of God in order to save a person from this damnation. Okay, now let's go a little bit deeper, because it's worth going a little bit deeper. Why do they understand that everyone is damned? So St. Augustine, when he's explaining this in a philosophy, he's a philosopher trying to explain Christian thought in light of, you know, rational thinking. And he explains that, and this part is true in our Midrashim as well, and that is that the area that some of the sin of the snake had to do with sexuality in some fashion, okay? And explaining that since it impacted sexuality and intercourse in general, therefore, I'm summarizing, but therefore, or simplifying maybe, but if he says, therefore, whenever there is intercourse, by definition, that is, there is a lack of knowledge, which is a reflection of the sin. By definition, that is a state which is only possible because of the sin, and therefore conception happens in a state of sin, and therefore, by definition, all of the descendants are therefore damned as well, are therefore impacted. You're with me? In other words, that's the Christian thought. The Christian thought is that since one of the things that is impacted in the sin is the inability to think as critically or clearly as possible, and that is manifest specifically in intercourse, and therefore by definition, if conception is happening through intercourse, of course, then that means by definition there is that sinfulness which is associated and a critical part of intercourse and conception, and therefore the sin gets passed on through the children, and therefore a person is born into sin. That is the Christian thought, and there's no way of saving this. There's no way of getting out of it. That's it.
What did the snake do?
Good question. It's a great question.
Symbolic.
So, yes, symbolic. Whatever exactly did it cause Adam and Eve to sin? However we understand it.
And Adam and Eve sinned by having intercourse.
Possibly, maybe. According to some, the intercourse not with each other, but according to some, that the simple reason. This is again, you'll find this in Midrashic literature and Jewish literature, that there is some notion of intercourse between the snake and Eve. Something happened, okay? We could spend another month or two explaining that sin. So, bottom line is, that's their approach. What?
A century,
yeah, possibly. So that's their understanding of original sin, and that's why there's this impact. Now, where does Judaism come? Now, Judaism does believe that the sin of Adam and Chava impacted future generations. The Torah says it. The Torah says, now because they sin, they'll have to, you know, all of a sudden you have these punishments, you know, there's going to have work, you know, and there's going to be pain in pregnancy and all those other things. There's going to be death introduced to the world. So everyone agrees that whatever happened in the garden, whatever it is, impacts future generations. No doubt, right? So there are major differences. I'll just mention them, right? Now, again, this is parenthetical, but I think important. Judaism does not see intimacy as intrinsically impure, like Christians do, right? Judaism, on the contrary, right? What is the biblical term for intercourse, for intimacy? Da'at, knowledge, right? To know someone biblically, right? That da'at. Da'at is the highest form of human, the highest human faculty in Jewish thought. The Ramban, Nachmanides, in another writing, which is attributed to him, describes a closeness of a person and their spouse as Kodesh Kadashim. Holy of Holies, right? The opposite of what, and he says, and the proof for that is because it's called Das, right? So in Christianity, they say there's a lack of Das, and therefore it's impure. Judaism does not believe there's potential for perversion, but in theory, the potential is also of the highest nature, that intimacy itself could be the holiest of holies in Jewish thought, right? So Judaism does not see intimacy as something which is dirty and impure, and therefore birth is not impure, But there is an impact from that original sin. So Judaism does have a form. So I want to be clear. The dirtying of intimacy is a Christian idea, not a Jewish idea, A. But they both agree that Adam and Eve, through their sin, impacts future generations. How? Okay, this is now we have to address how. Christians, I just explained how. In Judaism, how? Because we just said, you know, the intimacy is not intrinsically bad. One way of looking at this, which we're going to come back to soon, is the following idea. Bear with me. And this is something that Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto describes. And that is that Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, possessed what I'll call mega souls. What is a mega soul? It's a term I just made up. But the term of mega soul means that their soul was made up of all the souls. Adam's soul was made up of all the future souls of men. And Chava, Eve's soul, was made up of all the future souls of women. And therefore, if they made a mistake, it's going to, by definition, impact future generations. Because future generations, their existence is one with Adam. It's part of that same existence. It's just, you know, shows up in a different physical form. But that would be one way of explaining this notion. Now, again, the Christians see it because intimacy is impure and therefore it gets passed on. One way of addressing this in Judaism is to say that we were all there. Just like we have this notion we were all at Har Sinai, we're also all in the Garden of Eden. That would be one way of looking at it. So what he's describing over here, and there's so much more to say about this, but what he's describing over here, that that it could be that there's someone who truly, truly never sinned. It's possible. It's possible. Why would that person die? They would die bi'itav shel nachash, the bite of the snake. Meaning in their life as we know it, they didn't do anything wrong. But because of the sin of Adam HaRishon, because of Adam and Eve's sin, and because, let's just take this approach, they were there on some level, a person could die because of the connection of their soul, but not because of any of their particular sins. That's one way of looking at it, okay? And let's keep on reading now. Any questions? That makes sense?
That's Job.
Well, we'll get to Job. Okay. Let's keep on reading. Shenigzra misa lav al todosa v'shvil cheto. There is misa, death, which is decreed against all descendants of man because of his sin. Kedin shenemar. Okay, etc., etc. Okay. Fine. Let's turn the page for a second. Let's keep on reading. Okay. So we'll see another source, and then he's going to bring this together. Va'amu bebrachos. It was said in brachos. Bikesh Moshe lo dia derachav v'nasan lo. Okay, so it says in Brachos that God requested, Moshe requested of God to show him his ways, and God did. Okay, Shenemra hodiyeni nas derachecha. Moshe said, God, show me your ways. What does it mean, show me your ways? Amar lefanov, he said, Ribono shel ha'olam, master of the universe, mipnei ma yesh tzadik v'tovlo. Right, so there's a verse in Shemos where after the sin of the golden calf, where there's this very intense dialogue between Moshe and God. That's actually where we get the 13 attributes of Hashem. Hashem, Hashem, from that dialogue. And in that dialogue, Moshe says, Hodieni na estrachecha, teach me your ways. What does it mean, teach me your ways? Like where you go, what your traffic patterns are? What does it mean, teach me your ways? So the Gemara explains, what does it mean, teach me your ways? He was asking our question. Mipnei ma yesh tzadik v'tovlo. The ways that were hard to understand. God, why are there righteous people, right? What yesh tzadik v'tovlo? There are righteous people who it's good for, tzadik v'ralo. And there are good people, okay, that bad things happen to. Rasha v'tovlo, there are evil people who good things happen to, rasha v'ralo, and there are evil people who bad things happen to. There doesn't seem to be consistency. So Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe, how does God respond? Tzadik v'tovlo, a righteous person who good things are happening to. Why would that be? Based on everything we discussed. Who would be a righteous person who lives a good life? Let's think about this. Who would be a righteous person who lives a good life? How could that make sense? Because you have to, a righteous person, they should suffer here to remove their sins. Unless,
no sins.
Tzadik gamor. They are completely righteous, right? Right? So the only righteous person who could live a completely amazing life is a purely righteous person. Tzadik viralo, a righteous person who suffers, tzadik she'eno gamor, 98%, 95%, they still have 5% of sins. How do you cleanse them? They'll suffer here, so that they'll get a good portion of the world to come. Rasha v'tovlo, an evil person to whom it's good, rasha she'eno gamor. That's an evil person who also does some mitzvos. They do some good deeds. Where are they getting the reward? In this world. Rasha v'ralo, Who's a bad person who only gets bad? Rasha Gamra. That's a person who has no good deeds. No good deeds. Okay? So, okay, that's the end of the Gemara. That's the Talmudic statement. Vizeh, let's skip to the next paragraph. Vizeh ha'inyin al derech shepirashin lamala. And this is based on what we said above. Bipiron k'tzas ha'avonos ba'olam hazeh lizakosan legamre. That sometimes a person will pay or get, you know, punished for some of their sins in this world in order that they receive ultimate merit in the world to come. Ola vidu la'olam haba. Okay? Okay, fine. Let's skip the next line. And upliga dera meir. Let's go to number three. This is argued upon by Rabbi Meir. Detana mishmei de Rabbi Meir. Shelo nitnu lo le Moshe zehamida. Moshe did not receive an understanding of all of God's ways. Shenemar, there's an alternative approach. Vechanosi as asher achon. That God says, I will be gracious to those I will be gracious to. Afal pishe no hagun. Even though they are not fit. Virichamti as asher arachem. And I will have compassion on those who I will have compassion on. Afal pishe no hagun. Even though they are not fit. Kelomar sheno hagun ladas bnei adam, lomar, okay, that it's not fit according to the understanding of man. Lomar shlo nimsra mida zo ledaito shlo adam, meaning that the way, meaning God's ways, were not given over to the knowledge of man at all. So what he's saying over here is that although everything we've been discussing is what we'll call mainstream approach, it's worth noting that there is another individual, his name is Rabbi Meir, who says, no, we don't understand God's ways. That same dialogue, let's just, okay, I'm going to pull this together. I think this is getting a little confusing. There is a dialogue between God and Moshe, where Moshe says, tell me your ways. One approach says, God says, okay, I'll tell you my ways. This is the system. There's a system. There's another approach that says, God does not tell Moshe his ways. And God says, no, I'm compassionate to who I want to be compassionate to. You won't understand. I'm gracious to those I want to be gracious to, and you won't understand. So what's going on over here? What's going on over here is that there are two different approaches. There's one approach where God says, I will allow you to understand the system. And that's what we've been discussing until now. And then there's the approach of Rabbi Meir who says, you will not understand the system. The system is not understandable. Okay, meaning, let's go back to the question we asked a moment ago. We said, hey, all these prophets are asking the question of why do bad things happen to good people? So one easy answer we have now is, what's the answer?
It's not understandable.
It's not understandable. It's going like the opinion of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir is of the opinion that not all things are understandable, that there is no system. The system doesn't make sense. And God says, no, I'm doing things and you will not have any understanding of them. Too bad. This is my world. It's not your world. And we have to humble ourselves to that thinking. And many of us might be comfortable with that, saying, you know, I just don't get it. I don't get it at all. I don't even begin to understand it. All of our studying until now is a waste of time, according to a mayor. We don't have a clue. We don't have a clue, right? And that's the approach of a mayor. All the prophet's questions then would be legitimate philosophical questions. God, we don't understand. However, that's the view of Rabbi Meir, and perhaps Rabbi Meir alone. Most of the sages, it seems, disagree and say that we do understand a basic system, which brings us back to the question that we asked. So we just went on a little tangent. We asked, why are the prophets bothered by why do bad things happen to good people? Didn't we just spend all this time studying a system? Easy answer is they all go like Rabbi Meir. It's not a real answer because all the other authors in the Mishnah and Talmud have to deal with why all the prophets were asking this question. So according to Rabbi Meir, we have no question. But what about the other rabbis who say we do have a system? See, here's his answer. It's a beautiful answer. If you look at source at number four, he says like this. V'nei k'fiya svara harishona, according to the first explanation, meaning everything we've been discussing until now, hakol b'tam yadua, everything is in a well-known understanding. Uvitayna museges, an understandable claims. V'zesha omrim hanavim b'davar, and this that the prophets are speaking about this. U'mashit savchim ala inyan, and that they're crying out, eino ela k'divrei hachole. It's like an ill person, shemitzta'er al chalyo, who is in pain over their illness, umaflig al cheskas acholi, and they, you know, it's an intense amount of pain and of sickness, vitzoek al tokef atzar vakeev, and they cry out over the intensity of the pain and the discomfort. Veich ira lokach, how did this happen to me? Veich efshar inyan saro hagadzal, how could I be in so much pain? Kolomer, as if to say. Shanaviyah matzmim lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'omrim lefanav. What the prophets are ultimately saying to God is as follows. Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe. Lama tisnaig bezu hamida. Why are you acting this way? V'navla yameinu bebahala. And our days are being worn away through confusion. Ve'ela harasham shepashtu yadeim bezvul kadshecha. And the evil people who are, you know, putting their hands against your holy place, destroying the temple, etc. V'shalom v'shalva ba'olam, they are comfortable. V'afa pishi yodin shamida emes v'mishpat tzedek, even though they know that there's justice. Meaning, what he's saying is like this. Let me summarize or paraphrase. A person goes out into the cold. Okay, I'll give you a silly example. You go out to the cold. You took a shower and you go outside and it's negative. You know, I don't know, whatever. It's freezing outside, and lo and behold, 2 days later you get sick. Right? So, do you know why you got sick? Yeah, you have a pretty good knowledge of why you got sick, right? And we don't have to be so silly. You know, why do people get ill? There's you know, sometimes our genes mutate. I mean, it's part of the natural world, meaning mutations of genes is part of the way genes work. It's part of the system, right? So illness, we can understand why we're ill. So let's use the case of the cold. It's easier. I have a bad cold. I'm in a lot of pain. I'm a man, so I get to complain a lot if I have a cold, right? I'm sorry for all the men here. But right, it's terrible. My head's hurting. My nose is stuff. My ears are popping, right? So I'm in a lot of pain, and I'm crying. I'm in so much pain. Why am I in so much pain, right? I know I am in pain, but I'm crying out. I'm uncomfortable. It's normal. It's human nature to cry out when you're in pain, right? To be in distress. So basically, what he's saying is that's exactly what the prophets are doing. It's not like they don't understand intellectually. But there is an emotional response to situations of pain, right? Meaning, a bad thing happens to a person, and they know exactly why it happened, but they cry, I can't believe I made this mistake. Okay, what's that I? What do you mean? You made a mistake, you made a bad decision. Why are you yelling out? Because we're humans, and humans have emotional responses. That's how the Ramban is understanding all those sections in the Torah, where the prophets are calling out. It is not a academic, philosophical question. It is a question, they know exactly why bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. The reason they are calling out is because they're in pain. The same way we krechts when we're in pain. So I can understand why bad things happen to good people. I can still say, God, please, come on. It doesn't look good. It's wrong. You know, like, I get it intellectually, right? But come on, God, help us out over here, right? And that's, the cry is not, I don't understand what you're doing. The cry is, this is frustrating. It's not a good look when all the Jewish people are suffering. It's not a good look when the enemies of God are living it up, right? But it's not like I don't get it. I get why. But I could still complain about it. And I could still cry out about it. I can still pray about it. And that's how he understands all of those prophets' complaints. You with me? So let's just quickly summarize what we just saw over here. Yes?
But you don't really know why, because they've given 8 different...
Correct, reasons. Correct.
It could be because of your ancestors. 100%.
But if you believe in that, right? So the question asked, right? The question asked is that, wait a second. Even after we finish the Ramban, we're not like walking away knowing exactly why each thing happens. Oh, you stubbed your toe? Well, let me tell you why you stubbed your toe. Right? We're not doing that. We know, like, all we know is that there's a system. But if you truly, Isaiah, who believed in God fully and knew that there's a system fully, according to one approach that were the mainstream approach. So granted, I may not understand the details, but I know confidently there's a system, there's justice in the world, and I can attribute it. The fact that I have more options makes it even more compelling, right? I know why this is happening. It's either because you sinned. It's either because of the merit of your parents. There's like 15 reasons why a good thing could happen to someone who's not deserving, quote unquote. So I feel very comfortable. If I'm a Maimon, if I'm a believer, I feel very comfortable. So why then is such a person crying out? So he suggests, according to that approach, they're crying out because it's painful. There's a pain. Just like we feel pain, even though we understand things sometimes, it's painful. And that's how we understand all of those passages in the Talmud and the Torah, where these great people were asking the question that we're asking. It wasn't that I don't understand. It's that it hurts me. And therefore, I'm asking. Yeah, maybe a rhetorical question might be a good way of saying it. Yes.
Just quickly, perhaps in support of Rabbi Meir, who says that we'll never really understand it, that's not given to us to understand. There's a minority opinion. You might use the verse right there that says, the Moshe is denied the direct contact with
God. That's right.
Only the reverse.
You're in good company. That Talmudic passage that he quoted in support of Meir actually quotes that verse as well in support of it. Well, very good. You're good company. That's right. Right. Just to repeat what was just said, that is that when God, in the text, the biblical text, when God responds to Moshe about that question of show me your ways, what does God say? You could see, you can't see my face. you could see my back. So clearly, it sounds like God is saying, I can't show you everything, which does sound a lot more like Rabbi Meir, who says that we do not understand, right? And so, right, Rabbi Meir's approach is saying, no, none of these systems make any sense. We have no idea, right? And according to him, it's much more troubling because there is no system that even we can begin to understand. And but that passage in the Torah does seem to fit with that. Yes, Elliot. Excellent. Excellent. Excellent.
So that is very clear to understand.
Excellent. I believe what we're, so just to repeat the question for those who are not here, or those who didn't hear, the question is that what according to Rabbi Meir, there are certainly times in the Torah where there is clear consequence. You do something wrong, you know, Moshe hits the rock, he gets punished. We're going to read in this week's Torah portion, the Jewish people complain inappropriately, they get punished, right? So what do you mean that there is no, what I think Rabbi Meir is saying, I believe, is not saying that everything's chaos. Absent an explanation, right, if God says this is why, okay, this is why. It's not that God cannot do so or will not do so, but the point is that, and clearly there are times when it is a form of punishment, and we could draw a direct line between the misdeed and the punishment. His point is that everything outside of those scenarios where God weighs in on it and says why, we basically say there is no system. It could just happen. So I think that's the way it would be adjusted. Now, I want to just like make this, you know, again, going back to something we spoke about the other week. You know, again, a bad thing happens to someone. Let's make this practical for ourselves for a second. Bad things happen to someone else, okay? You're watching in the distance and there's a terrible flood in a certain region, right? And, you know, so do we have an ability to say it happened because of X? Do we have an ability to say that? I don't think so. Whichever approach you take, certainly according to Rabbi Meir, will say, who knows, right? According to the approach that says there is a reason, we can say, yeah, maybe it's for this reason, but it could also be for another reason. We believe Yesh Dayan. There is a judge in the world and there is a system, and it's one of these, you know, 15, 20 possibilities, but I don't know exactly which one. And so we have to be cautious when cautious. We shouldn't point fingers. That said, internally, if something happens to us, I'm just reviewing from earlier weeks, or if something happens to someone else and we are shaken by it, we also, it could be for a whole host of reasons, but if we want to be responsible adults and human beings and growing people, we should at least hedge our bets and say, it could be this happened to me because of, I don't know, let's think about last week. It could be it's nature. It could be because I'm a tzaddik and I'm getting my punishment in this world. Meaning, when a bad thing happens to me, I should say, you know, the reason's happening because I'm a tzaddik. I'm a great person. I should pat myself on the back and keep on doing what I'm doing. Or I don't think that's a good approach. Meaning, maybe sometimes we need to hear that. But I think the ideal approach is that when a bad thing happens to us, we want to say, it could be it's a punishment so that I'll get a better place in the world to come. But it could also be a punishment from God saying, I need to step up my game and do better, right? So the logical and appropriate moral approach as growing people is always, how could this make me better? It doesn't mean I have to say I'm a terrible person, that's why it's happening to me, but there's certainly a chance that some of this is punishment or whatever, and therefore the safe approach, the pragmatic approach, even if it's not always philosophically true, is always when something bad happens to us to say, how could I become a better person? That's always going to be the case. So a lot of what we're talking about is the theory, but practically speaking, when things happen to us, it can never hurt. It'll only help if we ask ourselves, okay, maybe this is a punishment. Maybe this is a message from God. How can I become a better person? I shouldn't beat myself up either. If I find myself beating myself up and saying, oh, I'm such a terrible person, that's why all these bad things are happening to me, I could always lean on the possibility that, no, Rabbi Meir, or even maybe I'm a tzaddik, maybe I'm actually a good person, and the reason I'm suffering is because it's taking away some of my punishment for the world to come. So you have all those places, right? It's complex, right? But there's all this space in your brain, which I think we should be tapping into. I go through something difficult. I'm just gonna repeat this again. I go through something difficult. Should I beat myself up? No. Maybe the reason I'm going through something difficult is because God is allowing me to suffer here in this world, to cleanse me so I can enjoy the world to come even better. So I should not beat myself up. And at the same exact time, I should say, hey, wait, maybe this is a punishment of some sort and it's a message from God that I need to change my ways. And that's also true. They could both be true, and so I don't know. That's the main point I want to bring out, that we shouldn't be, knowing that there's this variety of ideas, we shouldn't pick one over the other. We should find a balance between the two. On the one hand, say, hey, maybe I'm not such a bad person, and actually God is helping me for the world to come. At the same time, I am. None of us are perfect, and we do all need to grow. That would be the healthy, pragmatic response based on what we're learning, both the philosophy and the pragmatic steps forward. Okay? Let's go. Let's begin the Eov conversation. The last thing we just paraphrased. Okay, so let's go to number five. Ve'elu hein tochachal shel Eov hatzadik shebo yusurin alav. And this is part of the conversation and the arguments that take place. That'd be a better translation. These are part of the arguments that take place between Eov and his friends. Shebo yusurin alav shelo alchet kefi da'ato. Eov, at least according to his thinking, Job thought that he was completely innocent. Ukefima shenemar alav be'inina satan. And that seems to be the way that the Satan speaks. In the Satan, if you look through the book of Eov, the book of Job, in the opening chapter, you find Satan speaking to God about Eov. There's no mention of sin. Okay, alachinam yare Eov elokim. Vigmar inyon. Vim nomar bi Eov shum alila. O nechbas ben yano shemetz davar mikal makom hu shoel alatzad. He says, even if it's true that maybe Eov, Job, was guilty, but nonetheless, who shoel al tzadik gamor mikol tzad? Shebo alav yisurin. Job's questions are at least with the assumption that he himself is purely righteous, and at the very least, it's triggering him to ask about others who are purely righteous. Why do these bad things happen to him? How could these things make sense in the ways of God? V'davar ze ein lo tshuva l'das habrios, ela l'dato shel keldeos yisparach. And there's no easy answer, no answer, to the our knowledge, only to the knowledge of God. If someone is purely, it's completely innocent, right? Now here he's getting on this piece which we touched upon before. If a person is completely innocent, then there is no logical reason why they should be suffering here, right? Kach amru chachamim Rabbi Akiva. And this is a passage that's said about Rabbi Akiva. Sheheru so HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe Rabbeinu. God showed Moshe an image of the great sage Rabbi Akiva. Bemaros HaNevuah through a prophetic image. V'amar lefanav. And because Moshe said to God, Ribolo Shelolam, Master of the World, Harisani Toraso, Harisani Scharo. Moshe was shown an image of the great sage Rabbi Akiva. Our sages tell us, the Medrash tells us, that God gave Moshe a scan of all of Jewish history. And he sees some like amazing figures. He sees Rabbi Akiva along the way. And he says, God, show me his Torah learning and show me his reward. You know, the Talmud says that God allowed Moshe to sit in on a class of Rabbi Akiva. You know what the Talmud tells us? Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't follow the class. That's how profound and developed and profound it was. Right? That's hard to understand and it needs a lot of explaining. But there's this notion that Rabbi Akiva was on this incredible stature that even Moshe couldn't understand him. And Moshe now is like so excited. Wow, here you have this brilliant thinker, this person who's able to teach in a way that even I, Moshe, can't understand. Show me his reward. Show me his life. And you know what he shows him? Rasha Chotchim Besara B'Mekolin. He shows him, there's the famous, the Romans go ahead and they kill 10 leaders of the Jewish people. And the death of Rabbi Akiva was especially, all the deaths were terrible. The Rabbi Akiva, they went ahead and they took these metal forks, essentially, these large forks, and they started scraping his skin off. A terrible, gruesome death. And Moshe's head's like exploding. I don't understand. You just show me how great of a scholar is. And now he's having this type of death. Amar Lefanav. He says before him, Rabbono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Zu Torah V'Zu Schora. This is the Torah and this is its reward. Amar Lo, what does God say to him? Shtok al atzmecha. Be quiet. Kach ala b'machshava lifnei ritzo lefanai. This is what I decided to do. So what's going on over here? What's going on in this passage, right? Basically, we're seeing Rabbi Akiva, who is this great sage. Yes, he didn't live in early years, but he did tshuva, he repented, and he lives his for decades, this amazing life, dedicating himself to the Jewish people, dedicating himself to Torah scholarship, changing the way we think about the Torah. Rabbi Akiva is one of the most important figures in our history. And yet, this is his punishment. And so in this, and Moshe asked this question to God, and how does God respond? Be quiet. I don't want to hear your question. So who does this passage go along the lines of? It would seem Rabbi Meir, right? This is a Rabbi Meir type of passage where you have, right? Because basically what we're saying is that there are things which do not make sense. Things that do not make sense at all. And specifically the person that we would say that it's dependent on, if you believe that there's a notion of a tzaddik gamor, of someone who's completely righteous, and yet you see such a person suffering, it would seem to only make sense. It would seem to, right, the way we would make sense of that is to say that things don't make sense, right? In other words, if you were to say that there is a person in the world who is completely righteous, if such a thing exists, let's assume yes, If that is the case, and yet we see suffering in the world, and specifically two righteous people of that nature, of that stature, how do you make sense of it? So this is the Rabbi Meir approach, where he says, we don't understand all of it. There are questions that are unanswered, that don't follow, seemingly follow any system as we know it. Right? So again, just to summarize, there are two different viewpoints. There is one viewpoint that says, no, everything could follow a system, and presumably in that, within that approach, there is no notion of a completely righteous person. Every person is going to have some level of sin. And then you have those like Rabbi Meir say, no, there is no system, or to Elliot, to just qualify that better, there could be a system, but there are many things that are beyond a system that we have no understanding of. Within that worldview, we also have something called a tzaddik gamor, or a completely righteous person, like Rabbi Akiva, and we see a suffering, it makes no sense.
Was Job completely righteous?
So that's what we're going to get into right now. At least Job thought, and that's how we started. Job thought he was completely righteous. Was he or not is a matter of debates, which we'll get into. But certainly that is the dialogue in the Torah, where in the book of Job, where he's bothered because he thinks he's completely righteous, and therefore if he is completely righteous, again, let's just... okay, some of that's midrashic. You have to go look through the text to see exactly how he says he's a good person. But this notion of tzadi gamor, like free of sin, does sound like it. We'll see. We're going to see his treatments. We're going to see his treatments of the book of Job. But again, I want to just to summarize. The fundamental debate over here is, are there scenarios which don't follow the systems as we know it? Most say no such thing. Some say yes. The book of, now, what is that predicated on? It's predicated on a particular question, okay? The big question is predicated on a smaller question. Is there a completely righteous person in the world? If you say there are completely righteous people in the world who never sinned, then you're going to be bothered by this question. If you say that there's no such thing, and even the most righteous person will make mistakes, will sin on some level, you will not be bothered by this question, right? The book of Job is predicated on an assumption whether there is such a thing or not. He assumes, and the book assumes, you know, from his perspective, that he assumes that I'm completely righteous, and therefore he's bothered by this question, right? That's where this book begins, okay? Are we confusing? Too confusing? Are we good? Not clear. Okay, let's summarize. Two views. They're not as so different, but they sound very different. We've just, there is a question of why do bad things happen to bad people? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? That's the million-dollar question. The Ramban just explained to us that there are systems, mostly revolving around sin, that most of it could be explained by people sin, and therefore bad things are going to happen to them. That explains the bad in the world, okay, based on everything we've been saying. Based on that approach, when the prophets ask the question of why are bad things happening, they're not asking from an intellectual place, they're asking it from it's a rhetorical question, it's from an emotional place. Okay, done. Now, there are those who say that, no, while there are systems, and systems can explain many things, there are still unanswerable questions. The greatest example of such an unanswerable question is a completely righteous person, such as Rabbi Akiva, who suffers. Okay? Now, there are those who say there are unanswerable questions. Again, the example is Rabbi Akiva, who suffers, even though he doesn't seem like he should be suffering because he's completely righteous. There are those who take that approach. Within that approach, the prophet's questions were real questions. They were asking the question of why are bad things happening to good people, right? Summary, okay, that's approach number two. That's approach number two, okay? Simple as that. Now, the Medrash that speaks of Rabbi Akiva is just not agreed upon by those in category number one. They'll say, no, Rabbi Akiva deserved to suffer because he had some sins. Simple as that. The Medrash that says, God said, be quiet, is clearly going along the lines of Rabbi Meir, right? It's important to note, not all Midrashic literature has to line up with one another, right? Just like there are debates about halacha, about Jewish law, there are debates about Jewish philosophy, certainly, right? So again, you'll find Midrashim that seem to say there is no answer to this question, that's Rabbi Meir. There are Midrashim that say there is an answer to this question, it's everyone else. That's basically the way we're laying it out. The book of, now that we have that all in mind, the book of Job is predicated on an assumption that Job is completely innocent. At least that's the way he's thinking about himself, and therefore he's asking the question. Is he correct? We could debate. But it's predicated on an assumption. If you believe you're completely righteous and bad things are happening to you, it's a good question. It's a real question. It's an intellectual question, not just an emotional one. And we'll come back to Eov. He just mentions one thing in passing. He says, by the way, you should know, You know, let's just read it together. He says, Afalpi, in the last section, number six. Afalpi, nonetheless, ima lamazos, with this hiddenness, yesh betainazur, with this claim, so there is a secret, nimtzar la'amshei Torah ve'kabbalah, which is passed on to the people of Torah and the tradition, v'nirmaz beremez chachameinu zuchal v'rach, and it's hinted by our sages, v'nichlal b'inyan sod ha'ibor. It is included in the notion of the secrets of, what does ibor mean? An ubar?
The calendar?
Not calendar, but the word. A mi'uberet is in modern Hebrew. Yeah, Shana Muberet is a leap year, but it comes from the same word. An ubar is a muberet is someone who's pregnant. Okay, so there is this notion, the secret. So he says, let's go with approach number two of Rabbi Meir, that there are people who are completely righteous, and they suffer. On the one hand, we're saying that makes no sense; it doesn't follow any systems. He says, there is an answer to it, by the way. It's called the Sod HaIbur, the secret of pregnancy. What's he talking about? So I'll tell you what he's talking about. We'll learn the secrets. We'll learn the secret. I'm not going to, you know. Sorry?
Pain.
Not that part of pregnancy. But what is a Muberet? What is someone who's pregnant? They have someone else living inside them. That's what it means to be pregnant. You have someone else living inside them. There is a notion that the mystics believe. Not everyone agrees to this. The Ramban is of this category of people who believe in this. The notion of, and we touched upon this not too long ago, Gilgul, reincarnation. What is reincarnation saying? It's saying that someone else's soul is inside of you. You're not the first. Basically, the soul is being recycled. So the soul is basically inside of a person. And perhaps, okay, that's the general gist of it, right? Which is basically to say that you could have someone like Rabbi Akiva, who, let's say, according to Rabbi Meir, lived a completely righteous life, but he had the soul, or at least part of his soul, was from a previous life, and perhaps in that previous life, the individual did some bad things, and therefore, they will be punished for those actions. That is the Sod HaIbor, basically to say, yes, it's true. If you track this person from the day they are born to the day they died, you will see this person is completely righteous. Or even if they did sin, they did complete teshuva. Rabbi Akiva, yeah, maybe he made mistakes, but he dedicated his life to God. He did everything right. But there's the Sod HaIbor. And that's what he's getting on over here, which again, the mystics believe. And that is that even if a person lived a completely righteous life, it's possible that we are suffering for misdeeds of those who came before us. Based on this notion of reincarnation, that the soul I possess right now, there is impregnated in me the soul of someone else, either additionally, or that's my only soul, and that's already a discussion. Souls could be like, two souls coming together. That's already, we're getting a little beyond ourselves. But that's what he's touching upon Hindus. Over here. Not just Hindus, that's what he's saying. Jews, as Jews, now Hindus believe it's just a circle, right? As Jews, we believe it's a swivel, you know, basically like a corkscrew. In other words, the soul comes back, but not for the sake of coming back and coming back. The soul comes back for the sake of tikkun, for fixing itself, right? That's the notion, right? Thank you for bringing up Hindus, because in some Near East faiths, they also believe in reincarnation, but it's a big circle. It's an endless loop. There is no beginning and there's no end of time. It just keeps on going and going. In Judaism, we believe there's a beginning to time and an end of time. And therefore, the notion of transmigration, the notion of Gilgul, of reincarnation, is to say that a soul comes back into the world so that it gets fixed. So that now in this new body, it's able to either suffer for misdeeds, it's able to act better, to change things. That's the Sod HaIbor. He's not going to spend too much time on it. But that's the notion of the reincarnation. So, you know, the mystics do say, you know, I'll tell you who you're mystic. If you want to know, you know, who your previous life is. You want to know? Okay, here we go. You ready? Like this. So you say, they don't tell you, don't know a person. But he says, if you want to know why you're brought back into this world, this is I think it's where Chaim Vital says this, I'm blanking who. But they say that they're one of two ways to know. By asking yourself, what is the thing I am weakest at? I am the worst at? Okay, that's one indicator of why you're brought back into this world, meaning your soul, let's say, comes from a previous life. How do I know what it is? I have no idea why I'm here. Well, I'm going to keep on coming back, and I'm keep on, like, you know, there's all these movies where people keep on coming back and they don't know what they're trying here to accomplish, right? They, you know, they have this like or Groundhog's Day type of thing. You keep on coming back. Like, what am I trying to fix, right? Right. So that's there's a new version of that. I think whatever it is. Anyway, point is that you keep on coming. You don't know what you're fixing. So no, we do have an indication. We have a window into it. Ask yourself, what is the area I'm weakest in? That's one indicator. And B, on the flip side, is the area that I am the best at. What is one mitzvah I'm really good at? That could be that I'm here to be even better in that area. So you could take the more negative, you know, down approach. You could take the more positive approach. But either of those approaches, basically, if we believe, and many Jewish thinkers do believe, in this notion of our souls are coming from a previous life, and we're here to fix something. What am I here to fix? You don't have to go to some rabbi to read your palm. Look in the mirror. What am I not doing well? Fix it. What am I doing really well? Get better at it. And God willing, next time at 120 we pass on, we'll stay in the good place. We don't have to come back here to fix it anymore. Okay, we'll pick up next week. Thank you. Have a good one.